A poem called Learning from Trees by Grace Butler. Butcher. If we could, like the trees, practice dying, do it every year, just as something we do, like going on vacation or celebrating their birthdays. It would become an easy part of us, as our hair or clothing. Someone would show us how to lie down and fade away as if in deepest meditation, and we would learn about the fine dark emptiness, both knowing it and not knowing it, and coming back would be irrelevant. Whatever it is the trees know when they stand undone, surprisingly intricate, we need to know also, so that we can allow that last thing to happen to us as if it were only any ordinary thing. Leaves and lives falling away, the spirit complex, waiting in the fine darkness to learn which way it will go. Learning from Trees by Grace Butcher. All right, welcome back. So this is the last month of our year-long exploration. So if you're just joining us tonight, we've took the whole year to explore the Four Noble Truths. So you're working with the first three Noble Truths, and the last Noble Truth has eight parts, and this comes to the end of that. And this is wise concentration is the topic of this month. Now, concentration is an interesting word because I imagine if I told you all at the beginning of the meditation to really concentrate, to work on your concentration, would you find that you'd be more relaxed and easeful, or a little bit more stressed out, and a little bit more effort and strain? You know, when we just hear that word concentrate, it's easy to put an effort around it. Just a dictionary definition is the action or power of focusing one's attention or mental effort. Like frowning and concentration. You know, be quiet, I'm trying to concentrate. And this is how we tend to think of this word. So I think it's important to approach this topic, as many topics, a little carefully, to kind of notice what our habitual associations with concentration is and try to unpack it so it fits more in a supportive way for our meditative practice. Now, concentration is one of those things that I think many of us feel how distracted our minds are, how we're pulled in so many different directions. Our devices are constantly enticing us to shift to a new clickbait ongoing moment after moment. Really, we have this almost attention deficit way that we're being conditioned through the media, through our lives. Sometimes I like to watch, I don't watch TV, but sometimes when I watch it, like in my in-laws, I just count how many seconds there are between a change of image. And usually it's less than a second, and the new image flashes, the new one flashes. And that's how what we're conditioned to do. Look at this exciting picture. Oh, now this one, and then this one. And so we see how distracted we are, and we realize we're not very productive, we're not able to do our jobs very well, we're not able to pay attention. So concentration is very enticing. How can I get more of that? How can I be more productive? And then concentration from a meditative perspective brings in a whole nother type of baggage. Because if you look at some of the suttas, you know, you don't have to look very far. You can see that concentration is often kind of highlighted in some of the instructions. Some meditative teachers say that you have to, or really, it's really important to get deeper levels of concentration. Other teachers say it doesn't matter so much. You have to have a certain level of concentration, but not some of the deeper levels. But we hear that, and our minds love to have a project, something to obtain. Maybe I can get that merit badge of concentration. You know, get that little checkbox. Okay, I'm at that first jhana. So this is it's an interesting topic of how this all works. And concentration itself, I'll define it in a second. But again, different teachers look at it different ways. There's more rarefied or more dense versions of concentration. We call them samadhi states, or actually jhanas. Samadhi is the Pali word for concentration. Jhana is this almost like a trance state that everything else falls away except this one object. And there's eight different levels that I'm not going to touch on today because I'm not a jhana teacher. I'm not a jhana practitioner. And yet, some people say that's really important to practice with. While other people say that can sometimes get in our way, because those jhana states are very pleasant. They're very enticing. They're very beautiful. And you can feel like, okay, I'm really making progress because if I'm in those states. But sometimes we start to become a little attached to them. Like my teacher actually was really against jhana states because of that attachment he had seen in students. So it's having that, just that willingness to look at it. Well, today we're going to talk more about a natural type of concentration and kind of the whole landscape a little bit more. Because those states that we sometimes chase after, those bliss states, those too are impermanent. Those states too come and go. And really the purpose of our practice ultimately is to liberate our minds and our hearts. Right, so more on that in a minute, or a little bit later here. So what is concentration, from a meditative perspective? So it's the steadiness of attention. It's the attention that has an unwavering quality, a quality that it just rests with whatever it's focusing on. Right? It's undivided. There's a quality of unification, like the mind is really connected. Everything is like a whole sense of wholeness with what you're attending to. Right? And it can have a spectrum of expressions. We can have let's use light for example. So we can have a laser pointer that has a really laser pinpoint focus. Or we can have a much broader focus, like the light in this room. It can also be a form of concentration. Because what concentration does is it allows us to see more fully and more deeply, more clearly, to kind of see through our restriction. And that's one of the main benefits of concentration. Because for most of us, if not all of us, we kind of walk around in a bit of a fog. We have a fog of our habits, of our conditioning, of our delusion and ignorance. All these things kind of get in our way that we cause suffering for ourselves and others. And meditation, again, from a dharmic perspective, is about trying to see through that fog. So in some ways, it's like the sun trying to break through a foggy day. It starts to burn through eventually. So we can actually see what's actually present, what's actually here. We can actually see some of these deeper patterns. We can start to understand the nature of suffering and the release of that suffering. And there's like this wall of confusion and delusion that keeps us caught in that cycle. Concentration allows us to start to see through that, to actually see what's there. So concentration is almost like the sustained light that allows us to see something more and more fully, more and more clearly, right? So sometimes, if you've studied concentration states or have been around for a while, you may think of it as this really one-pointed focus, which is it can be part of that. But it can also be a much more relaxed quality of simply being present, simply hanging out, not trying to change anything, not trying to do anything, but you're completely present and aware. The mind is unified, connected to what's here right now. There's a quality of almost firmness of mind. Now, concentration states also, they're pleasant. They do feel good to be in a concentration state for the most part. There's a few things that sometimes come up around that. And so it also has been told, said to be like a way that shelters our mind from the hindrances. When our mind's really unified like that, the hindrances don't have much rooting. So it teaches us this kind of meditative pleasure, which is very supportive of us, as long as we don't become attached to it. We start to notice when we're attached, when we want to get back to that state, get back to that experience. And we're judging the experience we're having right now. So concentration states often have these other side benefits, like our heart rate drops or blood pressure drops. There's all these other qualities that science is so interested in. But really, the ultimate aim of practice is insight. You know, we call it insight meditation, Seattle Insight. And what insight means is this is a way of translating Vipassana, but it's really this seeing clearly and being changed by what's being seen, seeing it so profoundly, so clearly that it changes you. Now, I think we could go around and each one of us could share ways that meditation has changed the way that you are in the world, that you see yourself in a more full way, a more complete way. You start to see some of these patterns, they start to fall away. And there's deeper and deeper levels of that. And so concentration is an essential part of that process. Now, just to get a little technical for a second, that there's different levels of concentration. So there's kind of the normal mindfulness quality. Concentration is a little bit more steady, a little bit more focused, right? There's a point where we get to what's called access concentration. Okay, so that means that basically meditation is kind of running itself. The mind is pretty steady. At that point, there's a choice point of going into what's called the jhanas, or these trance states, when you get more and more deeper levels of concentration. Another point is toward insight, right? So different teachers disagree about how important it is to get to the deeper levels, but I think everyone agrees that the access point, that's the most important. That you may go into the deeper ones, but you come back to the access point for insights to start to arise. Now, we can think this might be just something you see on retreats, but you can also practice it in life, because it's really the point of being unified and connected with your attention. The attention becomes, you know, really solid around something. Think about something you're really interested in. You know, your mind's naturally connected around it. You're naturally focused around it. And you can have that same quality of curiosity and interest that can also bring you right into that state of concentration. Now, effort is an important piece to talk about around this. As I mentioned, the word concentration tends to load up our effort meter, right? We get more and more, okay, I got to work hard at being concentrated, got to focus really hard. Here's what the Buddha realized. So this is when he was, before he was the Buddha, he was practicing really intensely. He said, I thought, suppose with my teeth clenched and my tongue pressed against the roof of my mouth, I beat down, constrained, and crushed my mind with my mind. Then, as a strong man might seize a weaker by the head or shoulders and beat him down, constrain him, and crush him, so with my teeth clenched and my tongue pressed against the roof of my mouth, I beat down, constrained, and crushed my mind with my mind. Sweat ran from my armpits while I did so. Though tireless energy was aroused in me and unremitting mindfulness established, yet my body was overwrought and uncalm because I was exhausted by the painful effort. Right? So, does that sound like your meditation? I hope not. But sometimes the sense of concentration, I got to work really hard at it. So the Buddha took that to a very deep level. He practiced it to that level. But he realized, you know, it doesn't really take me as where he wanted to go. He thought, whether a monk or a Brahmin has felt in the past or will feel in the future or feels now painful, racking, piercing feeling due to striving, it can equal this that I'm experiencing, but not exceed it. But by this grueling penance, I have attained no distinction higher than the human state, worthy of the noble one's knowledge and vision. Might there be another way to enlighten it? So basically, he tried really forcing his mind to be concentrated, and has also went through a lot of deprivation, eating very little, you know, sitting for long periods. And he really worked his body and his mind so hard to try to obtain this goal of meditation, to obtain liberation. But he realized this is not going to work. This is not going anywhere. And then he thought of the time when his father was working and he was sitting in a cool shade of a rose apple tree, right? Quite secluded from sensual desires, secluded from unwholesome things. And he entered into a deeper level of meditation, but from a place of relaxation, from a place of ease. I think that's one of the big things I want us to try to get, is our concentration is actually not something that we push ourselves to, but more we relax into, right? We relax into it. We balance our minds. We try to find a sense of balance, a sense of ease. And then from that place, even a sense of happiness, in that place, we become receptive to what's present. And that naturally becomes more and more connected. Because effort is needed to some degree, but it needs to be a wise effort. And it can easily get in the way. It can easily be too much tension, too much tightness of the mind, of the body. In some ways, concentration is maybe more attuned to chemistry definition of it, where you take particles and you just concentrate them. They're all, it's density of that substance. In this case, the substance is our attention. Our attention is just present and landing, right? So concentration doesn't have to be always a quality of isolating from everything. It can actually be a quality of just being present, being connected to what's here and right now. Think of when you're in talking to someone who's really present with you, who's really listening deeply to you, that's not thinking ahead or trying to judge or fix you, but they're just listening in a very deep way. You know, they're present, they're connected, they're interested in you and how that feels. That's the quality, this is a gateway into concentration, into this more natural quality of awareness. In this way, the attention, the meditation starts to do itself. There's a way it starts to sustain itself. And for many of us, especially in our busy lives, we spend the first part of our meditation just trying to calm this system down, trying to feel our bodies, can I get the mind not to be so lost? And the more, as I try to guide in the meditation, the more we can just acknowledge and make space for how the mind and body is, how the heart is, that space allows us to relax. And then from there, we're actually connecting with what's here. And you can focus on the breath, body, on sound. Now, concentration, this is all very important for our meditation practice. But this month is around wise concentration. Okay, so what makes it wise? How does that come in? Because I think we've all seen, the movies where the sniper is so focused on their target. They have a lot of focus, right? A lot of concentration. But yet they have an agenda to cause harm, to kill. Maybe it's their job, or we can talk about that some other time. But a sense of concentration, what it needs is this other element. And last week I talked about the Great 40, this fun sutta from the Majjhima Nikaya, I think 117. And the Buddha is talking about concentration. He's saying, now, what, monks, is right noble concentration with its supports and requisite conditions? All right. So he says, any singleness of mind equipped with these seven factors, right view, right resolve, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, and right mindfulness is called noble right concentration with its supports and requisites. Hopefully that list seem familiar at this point. So that's the whole eightfold path. So it's basically saying that each of these path factors don't go by themselves. They have to have all these other elements to help balance them, to bring them into a sense of this noble path that's leading toward awakening. So concentration by itself isn't so helpful in terms of the depth of our practice. And that's an important piece, because sometimes we think that we can do concentration in isolation. Okay, if I can get away from everybody, go to a cave and just focus on my breath or stare at a candle, that's how I'm going to have this gateway into concentration. And there's a level of that that's true. But for it to really be this fruition of the path, it needs the other path factors, including how we live in our lives, including how we speak, how we act, how we make a living. And this is a bit of a surprising definition, the way he chose to talk about it. Not in terms of the meditative states or the different jhanas, but it needs to have all these other elements. So part of this is, how does concentration What's the relationship between ethics and concentration? So ethics, we can think of it as that middle section of the Eightfold Path, the wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood. How do we act in a way that's really living our understanding of the Four Noble Truths, living our understanding of what causes suffering, what causes the release of that suffering? So one way to think about this is this another fun Pali word called papancha. Okay, people familiar with that word? Papancha. So it means proliferation of thought. Okay, papancha. So proliferation of thought. Think of it like popcorn. It starts from one pops and another one pops, and soon the whole bowl is full. And this is how our minds often work, right? You're just doing something, you think of something, you see something, you hear something, and your mind takes off to the races. And then that's why you wake up 20 minutes later realizing, oh, I'm somehow down 20 years ago in my mind, right? We get taken down this thought stream. This is proliferation of thought. One thought leads to another thought. That's in some ways opposite of concentration, right? If we're really lost in thought, we are disconnected from what's here. We're not connected to this present moment. There's no sense of sustained quality. So a busy, distracted mind in some ways is the opposite of concentration. Now, how ethics fits into this is that when we're acting in an unethical way or acting in a place of harshness, or we're telling things which aren't true, or we're kind of closed in our hearts, that generates a lot of internal dialogue, right? Have you ever noticed that? If you tell a lie, does your mind feel pretty quiet after that or during it? If you take something that's not yours, does the mind say, oh, that's nice, I can just relax into quiet? The mind's kind of worried about getting caught, or that tension, or justifying why it's okay in this circumstance. Or have you ever felt a sense of anger or harshness towards someone and you act from it? Does your mind feel pretty relaxed and calm from that? You know, or you experience it. You know, there's all this inner turbulence that comes from that, those expressions of unkindness. And really what's happening is these are flowing from these unwholesome roots of greed, of hatred, and delusion. In their very nature, they cause a lot of inner turbulence, a lot of inner static, if you will. Think about, you know, any movie that you've watched that's very compelling, or, you know, a limited series or whatever it might be. The more unethical things are, the more interesting it is. There's a lot of things to think about, a lot of dynamics, what's happening to this character, to this character. And our minds are really busy with that, right? And this takes us away from that quality of concentration. If we take like a glass of water and we suspend a bunch of dirt in it, shake it up, it's going to stay suspended. So that shaking up is when we keep acting from that way. We keep saying things which are untrue, or we get lost in our anger and our reactivity. We get lost in our greed. We get lost in our separation. So all that shakes that up and keeps it suspended. Well, if we simply quiet down, that mud starts to fall down. Now contrast that with when we act from a place of generosity, from a place of kindness, from a place of connection. Well, how does the mind respond to that? You know, it perhaps is a little bit more quiet. There's a sense of settledness. It's like, okay, I did something that was kind and generous. I can reflect on that, and there's a quality of feeling good about myself, good about that action, and the mind gets a little bit quieter. Concentration becomes more available. Yeah, that's an important piece. I think that's one of the messages that why Eightfold Path has such a prominent section on and wise action, wise speech, wise livelihood. Because without that, we're just staying turbulent. The Buddha originally would teach people not so much the meditation techniques, but starting first with their ethical actions. Because he knew if they were acting in an unethical way, they would be causing a lot of inner turbulence. He also had them practice generosity of actions, of spirit, of money, or whatever is appropriate. Because when we act from a place of generosity, our hearts start to open. We start to soften. If we act from a place of non-harm and kindness, our hearts also start to open and soften, and our minds start to soften. And then from that, those two being in place, meditation then starts, takes a better root. Concentration becomes more and more accessible. That concentration, it's one of those things, it's a paradox, because I've heard many students tell me that they just feel so much, so limited in concentration. Their minds are so busy, so distracted. Sometimes they name a concentration as a point in itself. Or how can I practice with my mind being so busy, so divisive, so going all these different directions? And part of it is that we tend to judge our meditation by how it feels and how we think it should be instead of how it actually is. And here's the biggest secret I've learned, is that the less we make a big deal about what our mind is doing, the easier it is, right? So if our mind says something or thinks something, we have a disturbing thought, we have a reaction, and we react to that, we create more and more turbulence. We say, okay, that's just the mind having its thing. It's a little cranky, a little irritated. If we're able to step back and notice that, we're step back into this quality of observing, of mindfulness, right? This is the prerequisite for concentration, to be able to observe this. And then we can start to move into that more of that unification of mind. And it's also hard for us to have concentration when we're coming from a place of self-deficiency, that sense of lack. How can I ever get quiet? My mind's so busy. How can I attain this level of stillness? The sense we lack in ourselves, the sense of lack, or a sense of in the moment, it injects a level of tension. But the more we can relax of how things are, it's like you're just creating a little space for how you actually are. You know, you're not going to change the fact that your mind's busy in this moment, but just stop fighting it. And then you start to observe it, bring a quality of compassion to it. And then you start to find there's a stillness that arises. So it's really relaxing. Sometimes just relaxing into the simple perfection of this moment is all that's needed. Okay, just sitting, I can feel my breath. I can hear sound. And nothing needs to be changed in that. You know, not striving to get concentrated, not striving to get anywhere. Paradoxically, that's the fastest way for concentration to start to arise. Right? And remember, concentration doesn't have to be this one isolated, nothing else but this one thing. It can be simply being present, being connected. Like this light in this room, the room that you're sitting in at home, how much effort does it take to meet you, to see you, to observe you? There's really effortless. And how much does it judge or evaluate what it's shining upon? It just notices it, right? And that's that same quality of concentration, is meeting this moment just how it is. There's this steadiness of attention. And we just relax into that. And then it starts to do itself. All right, let's just sit quietly for a couple moments, letting those words settle. And then we'll have a chance for any questions or sharing about concentration. As we sit together, one thing to steady your attention upon. Maybe it's the breath, or sensations, or sound. And notice, are you trying to place your attention upon that, or are you letting that sense data come to you? Is there a quality of receptivity, of welcoming it to you? And then everything else You can just let that slough off. No need to argue about it or get reactive to. Just letting that one sense data start to come to the foreground. Letting the mind become unified around this one breath, this one sensation. And then open your eyes, but keeping this quality of unification of mind. And now you're simply observing what's around you. That sense of steadiness, that sense of unity, this is an expression of concentration. All right, so we have a chance now for any questions or sharing you might have. And if you're here in the room, you can raise your physical hand. We'll bring a mic over so they can hear you online. Online, you can raise your virtual hand and I'll call on you. Yes, up here in front, Suze. Yes.
So concentration, it also appears in a bunch of lists.
Yes.
And I think it's in the seven factors that it comes right after rapture or joy. And that's always been interesting to me. Could you speak to that connection between rapture or joy and leading to concentration?
Is it concentration or is it tranquility after rapture?
Good question. But it's they seem to be sequential, and it's certainly joy is right in there. And it might be joy and then tranquility and then concentration. And it seems really connected to what you've been talking about tonight about be more relaxed, allowing it to percolate up,
yes,
but, and not forced, but that connection with joy or rapture.
So joy is an easier connection to make around concentration, at least right here in the moment for me. Because joy basically, sometimes we think of concentration and that leads us to a sense of happiness. But really, happiness itself becomes the nice conditions for joy. Like next year, we're going to be exploring the transcendent origination, and that's how they have it, actually. Joy comes before concentration. It comes a few links beforehand. But you think about it, when the mind is kind of relaxed and soft, it's kind of bright and energized, then it's able to really, it's able to relax. It's able to be present. There's a quality of release of tension in that sense of joy, right? Rapture or pitta, so rapture is one of those words we are going to have to unpack a little bit. Rapture has this, it's often it's a welling of energy that sometimes isn't very pleasant. It's like the energy is kind of rising in the system. And if the seven, you talked about, excuse me, the seven factors of awakening, so there's investigation, and then from that seeing, there's this energy that starts to rise as you see things more clearly. But sometimes it's a little bit out of balance. You know, it's like, oh, this is really intense. And so it's, you know, it's kind of like playing with those different things. But you're right. It comes in many different lists. And that's, you know, different ways that the Buddha pulled that out and plugged it in. It's also interesting which lists it's not in, too.
Thank you, Tim, because it, having it be joyful before that creates part of the conditions for concentration, it also would come after.
That's right. Yeah, and it's both a precursor and also a result. Yeah.
Thank you.
So that's a good way to practice it. If you really want to work on concentration, first kind of brighten the mind. You know, reflect on, you know, the good that you've done, or generosity, or kindness, all those qualities. And that starts to brighten the mind, and then concentration is much easier to come forth. Trying to do it from a place of like self-deprivation or lack, okay, I got to get to this, I got to get my concentration stronger, that we're just coming from a tense perspective that doesn't really help so much. You bet. Thank you.
Hey, thanks for the talk, Tim. I was wondering if you could speak more towards the distinction between mindfulness and concentration.
Yes.
They both seem really, really quite interconnected, but and they both kind of focus on allowing awareness to arise naturally and approaching it with compassion and acceptance and whatnot. But yeah, I was just wondering if you could talk about the actual difference between the two.
Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, as Suze was mentioning, you can see, you know, see those two paired in different lists, and sometimes one's there and not the other one. And of course, the Eightfold Path, you know, there's that particular way that's in the whole bhavana or cultivation section of it. So mindfulness, we can think of it as being this almost objective or non-influential perspective of knowing, of perceiving, trying to perceive things how they actually are. And so there can be a quality of a receptivity, the quality of compassion around it. And mindfulness itself can go from a spectrum of being very broad and open, you know, like choiceless awareness or just being aware in a more natural state. It can also be much more focusing on one thing. When it starts to get into focusing on one thing, that becomes more on the lines of concentration. So it's almost like a Venn diagram. There's some crossover, some way it starts to blend together. And so concentration, from a mindfulness perspective, that's when I'm choosing to focus on just one thing, focusing just on the breath, focusing on the breath on one part of the body, you know, and if everything else falling away. So that's building this quality of samadhi and steadiness or concentration, right? But at the same time, that concentration, the other way that it works too, that concentration can be just the way when the mind becomes much more stabilized. You know, you're not really having to work at being steady and present. You're just there. So the mind is more concentrated at that point. Right? So you see there's kind of this whole, both of those words have lots of a spectrum of expression. You know, and same thing with concentration can be this being present, being connected, you know, versus, you know, being maybe like really, everything else is gone except this one moment of this one breath. You know, but everything, I'm disconnected from everything else. So that's probably the biggest change, is that mindfulness tends to be connected to the arising and passing of experience, while concentration kind of gets a little bit sequestered in the more extreme versions of it.
Right. It's almost like concentration is kind of how mindfulness is applied, whether how narrow that is or how broad it is.
Well, I would say concentration is an element of mindfulness.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's true. It also has these other elements which are really essential too. Well, concentration can be more practiced in isolation in a way.
Okay.
But again, we're talking about the Eightfold Path, so I think it's a more broader type of concentration than the kind of the deeper qualities.
Right. That makes sense. Thank you.
You bet. All right. Anyone else? Yeah, go ahead, Leslie.
Yeah, hi. I'm not sure how much this fits in what we're talking about, but it seems to me that it does. It says,
yeah.
When I'm meditating, I frequently have my eyes closed. And what seems to happen is as soon as my eyes are open, I am up and out. I'm gone from my, you know, my meditation feels gone. Like I get distracted. I start looking at things and naming them even in my mind, even without thinking about it. Can you speak to that? It's like, I'm trying to practice just looking, but I think I feel like it's that grasping, out there versus staying present.
Yeah, that's a great question. So when you're meditating with your eyes closed, so generally we suggest that, but there's not a requirement. Some people find eyes open are more, is more comfortable or more grounding. That's perfectly mm-hmm. fine. Mm-hmm. But eyes closed, what you're basically doing is kind of closing off a major sense gate, right?
Yeah.
And you're just sensing the breath and the body. You're still hearing things. Venerable Panawati sometimes would lead meditations where people would put blindfolds on and earplugs in to kind of close down more sense data. Mm-hmm. So you just have this one thing to focus on. Mm-hmm. And so it's one thing we can talk about is more an exclusive type of meditation, feeling just one thing versus inclusive and feeling broader things. Both have their validity there. Mm-hmm. So basically when you're focusing just on the breath with your eyes closed, things are more simple. It's just tracking one thing at a time. In some ways it's, maybe it's not like that. No, I'm not going to use that. So just focusing on that one. Okay, I'm going to use that example. So let's say I was juggling, but I'm just juggling one ball. Okay, so mm-hmm. I'm catching that one ball. I open your eyes and suddenly I have three or four balls and I'm trying to juggle all of those. Mm-hmm. Right, so that sometimes that becomes a little discursive. But what I encourage you to do is play with that a little bit, Leslie, because that big shift that you're noticing, I think it's there's some learning that you can do around that. Mm-hmm. So what you can play with is you're meditating and you're feeling that steadiness and just open the eyes a little bit, kind of like when you're a kid and you pretended like you were asleep, but your eyes are just a little bit open and you thought your parents mm-hmm. didn't notice. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you're kind of just seeing, seeing things just a little bit. Mm-hmm. All right, so you're letting a little bit of input in, and you can close your eyes. And then maybe open your eyes and just gaze at one thing, and just notice how the mind changes, how the mindfulness changes.
Okay.
And they go back and forth, and see if you can teach yourself basically how to be mindful with your eyes open.
Okay. That sounds great, because that's kind of what I need at this point, I mean, to carry it out into everyday life, I'm not going to go around with my eyes closed. So.
Yeah, that's more difficult, right?
Yeah.
So. And the eyes carry, sight can carry so much meaning to it, right? Mm-hmm. I see something and my mind's labeling right away. And here's another way to play with it, is I like to do this outside, like with a tree or something, or you could do it like a plant in your house or a picture. Notice it. Open your eyes and notice what the mind says about it.
Okay.
But then notice that that's being said about something that has its own expression, right? The tree doesn't really care what you think about it. It doesn't care if you like it or label it. It's just mm-hmm. there, right? Mm-hmm. So that's something you're adding to it. So then you start to peel away those things you add to it to try mm-hmm. to get to just the bare seeing of it, the bare mm-hmm. experience of it.
Yeah, so letting go, trying to let go of the concept and focus on,
notice the concepts and see how that's different than the actual thing.
Yeah.
Because if you try to let go of the concepts, sometimes there's another concept trying to let go of itself.
Yeah.
It gets we
used to do that in art school, was trying to let go of what what your mind was saying. That's a stop sign, and look at what it's actually how it's actually constructed, or right? You don't actually see what you're looking at when you put a concept on it. So
that's right. Okay. Yep. Yeah. So it's going that direction.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you, Leslie. Okay, go ahead, Charlotte.
Thank you. I was wondering whether you could talk to me a little bit about how to have the sort of gentleness that you're talking about, like the non-forcefulness, not like bearing down on this concentration, but like the like relaxing into it, like having that piece of it, but also bringing the, I don't know, like a little bit of intentionality to it.
Yeah.
find sometimes that when I'm succeeding with that a little bit, I'm just sort of like relaxing into that kind of concentration. As soon as I notice it, then it like tightens up again. I feel like I'm
yes.
Like notice where I'm at, but I also, you know, I want to, I don't know. I guess that's just where my question is, like how to have like the little bit of like choicefulness or intentionality about the concentration, mm-hmm. about like directing that softly, but also like not trying to hold it so tight, like just balancing those pieces up.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, in some ways it's around our, this, I don't know if this makes sense, but kind of the heavy-handedness of our meditation that we sometimes have. This is a common experience. When I instruct people to focus on their breath or the sensations of their breath, it's hard to focus on the breath without changing the breath, right? You're breathing in, breathing out. You're actually, your breath is just doing its thing until you start to notice it. Then you start to control the breath. And so at some point we start to learn how to just let the breath be itself, you know, kind of do itself. And yet there's still the intentionality of turning toward it. So what you might play with you know, that process of like, okay, start to feel like you're deepening and you notice, you recognize that, and then you kind of takes it away. Is that what you're saying? Kind of backs you out of it.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So you start to feel it and just basically you can just notice that whole process. Okay. I'm aware that I'm starting to concentrate and then I kind of get excited by that but see that in itself. So you're kind of seeing kind of the reaction to it. So you're kind of stepping back and saying, okay, if I get kind of churned up or reacted around it, that's okay. If I get excited around it, that's okay. And the more you kind of relax with the fact that you do that, then you just start to find that access point around it. Sometimes telling yourself, just reminding yourself, okay, there's no place to be, there's no place to get to. I'm just noticing what's actually here. And here's another clue you can play with is kind of letting the locus of meditation shift from being in your mind down to your body, almost like the body is what's sensing. Because the mind's going to tend to kind of do all these kind of tricks and stuff. But the body can just sense it. It's like, okay, thank you, mind. Here's what the body's experiencing right now. And trying to feel it in a very simple, innocent way. You know, It's like being in nature. I was sitting meditating the other day and all these birds started to come nearby me. You know, they were feeding. I was still enough. They didn't recognize me as a person. But then I moved and they all kind of freaked out and ran away. And so it's like just having that movement be very smooth and slow. So it's more of that internal movement.
Thank you. I wonder... like to build that up, is it mostly a practice piece? Like sometimes I almost feel like I don't trust it. Like as soon as I start to like feel that letting go, like then I'm noticing myself noticing it, you know?
Yes.
Is it a practice thing more than anything?
I'm sorry, I'm getting a little hard to hear you say
again. It's just practice really, just to like build that, like the trust with that like gentle piece of it.
It's practice. Yeah, definitely need time on the cushion or time on the chair or whatever it is. But you also need to have it be informed too, I think is helpful. So what I mean by that is we're not just kind of going through the motion, that we're practicing and learning as we're practicing. We're learning when that pattern arises, what that feels like. You know, we're not trying to change it, but we're just trying to notice it more fully. And that starts to let the practice be the most effective and helpful. And often for kindreds, as we talked about joy as a precursor, sometimes just starting by noticing, you know, is the hindrances here? Is my mind kind of cranky and contracted? Am I irritated? Am I feeling, you know, tight? And don't judge that, but just create some space around it. That also starts to lead into that quality of a receptivity. Because I can almost guarantee if you sit down and you're trying to get yourself concentrated, and it's not working well, that frustration is going to make you go further away, right? But if I can just relax with, okay, it's not working, all right, what can I make contact with right here? And that starts to become this gateway into that steadiness.
Thank you.
Right, sounds like some good territory to explore. All right, anyone else like to share or ask anything?
Hi, Tim. I had a question, but your answer just like threw things away. So I had a question about when you talked about the access, and you can either like go towards like kind of the trance state or like Jonah or Jonas, or yeah. Better is the more like insight
yes.
path. And so when you said that, I was like, okay, sometimes it's rare, but when it happens, it's nice. It's like I have this kind of like body experience to describe, like your body is kind of it goes from your mind to more your, like your body. So I don't know, it's like you become like a stone, you're very relaxed. It's like very, very pleasant. And for me, I thought that's the kind of the bliss or like trance state and what you should avoid maybe. But what you described sounded like it's maybe what you should, once you're there, like you should stay there and try to not get away from that. Do you see what I'm trying to describe? Or?
Kind of. Say it a little differently.
All right. So between the trance state or the insight state, how do you know which one you are in?
How do you know which choice you've made? You know,
yes.
Which direction, which fork in the road you went to?
Well, can you see the fork and make a decision, or do you realize it after you made the, without knowing it, you made the decision?
Well, I'm not a jhana teacher or a jhana practitioner. I think it's really, if we've trained in those systems, there's often, you know, a particular methodology that teachers cultivate, different imagery or different ways of kind of inviting us into those points. If you haven't been trained in that way, I don't think you have to worry too much about it. You know, basically, it's like if you've been trained in it, though, then you see that point more clearly. Oh, here's this point I can go into more of a jhana territory. But if we haven't been really trained in that, just keep practicing, just keep deepening into that. So you might kind of go into some of the concentration jhana territory accidentally, but it's okay if you're just so present for what's here. And another way to describe it is, in jhana, you tend to become more and more one point, like everything else is disappearing except this one experience, this one breath, right? And sometimes time falls away. Well, in a more of an insight practice, you're aware of what's arising. You're aware of what's present. So you can feel that sensation. You can feel this breath going through. You can start to notice maybe the rising of a hindrance. You can notice the rising of greed or of hatred. Or you can start to notice that sense of self arising or how that forms. You know, but there's a sense of being aware of what's present versus being kind of really sequestered into one area.
Okay, thank you. That helps.
You bet. Cheryl, right next to... Yeah.
Thanks, Tim, for your talk. I had a question at the very beginning of the Q&A that somebody else essentially answered, but now I have a follow-on question.
Okay.
So the first question was going to be, in a way, is concentration almost like loving presence, loving intentional presence, and it sounds like in many ways often, yes. But the one that's been coming up is, in thinking about concentration in that way, I'm realizing that often my capacity to concentrate often feels lower when my self-compassion is lower and when fear or fatigue or stress is particularly high.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if, And none of that is like surprising in any way. But I'm wondering if there are any, if there's anything you'd recommend practicing with, especially around like concentration or presence and self-compassion, particularly navigating if, you know, there's a large space of stress or fear in life that needs acknowledgement and needs care, but there needs to be room for concentration too.
Yes. Yeah, this is an interesting territory as I hear your question and just the way I've talked about it and other people's question around concentration. And I think we can just to do a quick preface to your question, we can think of concentration, there's like a state of concentration, like a more dense quality of concentration, and there's also just the way the mind can be more steady, more connected. And then that's kind of that Venn diagram that's kind of got other elements kind of mixed in with it, like compassion, you know, that quality, that compassionate connection. But to, I think to get to the, perhaps the heart of your question is when, you know, it just feels like the heart's tight, it's closed, I'm overworked, I'm stressed, there's, you know, I'm really burdened and concentration seems so far away. How do I access it? How do I find a footing? Is that basically it? Yeah. Well, Sue's mentioned the seven factors, and I personally like to bring investigation to that process. So investigation is sometimes is like when we're stressed or we're dealing with a difficult thing, there's the surface experience of it, but there's also the deeper experience of it, kind of the meaning that's often not seen. So sometimes I like just, and this also brings a psychology perspective to it. Okay, what am I believing is true right now? You know, what is kind of the heart of what's true? Because sometimes it's not really the argument and the details around that. It's something much more tender in some ways. Something that maybe makes more sense from a younger perspective or something like that. And connecting with that and just, that's, so it's almost like being more accurate with what we're connecting to. What's really the source of this pain? If we've practiced for a while, we may start to notice that our patterns are kind of simple in a way. There's kind of like this root that we find lots of creative ways to express it, right? You know, for myself, a lot of it was around self-inadequacy and self-deficiency. And I would find lots of ways to make that happen in lots of different scenarios. And it was overwhelming until I realized, oh, there's this one thing. And if I can learn to attend to that, and then that's possible to feel, okay, can I have compassion for that quality? Can I open to that? So investigation is almost like connecting to the core of that pain. And then you bring compassion, give space to it. And I try to use different words because sometimes it's hard to find love for those places. Then maybe can I just create a little space for it, a little bit of breathing room. And instead of being like a straitjacket, it's like, okay, I can breathe with that a little bit. And by doing that, you're already starting to open to what's here right now. And you're already starting to open to being present, being connected, which is why I'm kind of using concentration and I'm really stretching the definition tonight. But it's like just being present with what's here. Yeah, you're welcome. Well, one other quick piece of that is what's here, but also what am I not allowing about what's here? How do I think the moment should be different than it is? Sometimes that's really helpful to acknowledge. All right, yes, go ahead. Go ahead, Beth.
If I can just piggyback on what y'all are talking about, I'm thinking about Philip's teachings, and I want to give a plug for attending his weekend.
Yes.
He speaks to a very lovely approach to it turns out to be concentration, but he talks about the felt sense.
Yes.
And about just, help me, I just lost it. Okay. The felt sense. Arriving, being available. And, oh, his teacher, Ajahn Sumedho, would talk about like something like feeling stressed.
Yeah.
Is like this.
Yes.
And then going back to the felt sense in the body, and that seems to, he refers to collecting and unifying the mind.
Yes.
And in a really nice, easy, approachable way. So I highly recommend spending at least one of the days with him.
Yeah, Philip has, he's really masterful in how he, kind of like the technology of how do you work with the mind, and he's really thought things through in a beautiful way.
Yeah. He talks about choice a lot.
Yeah, choice.
Choice. Mm. Is that the word you're looking for?
All right, you go ahead over, and then we'll come back to Anne-Marie in a minute.
Okay, I have what might be more of a beginner question, because when you were talking about not bringing a lot of effort into the concentration, more often than not when I try to release that effort, I feel more of a sense of listlessness or aimlessness or a total lack of focus. So I guess I just wanted to, and in other areas of my life, like whether it's work or exercise or hobbies, like most of, I'd say my concentration is almost always very effortful, where I'm like really working to focus on something.
Yeah.
So like my mind only knows one form of concentration.
Right.
So I guess my question would be like how to start practicing that and how to not get into the lost or listlessness or aimlessness.
Yeah, I think that's an important question around it. So I think you said it yourself, is that the mind knows one way to be concentrated, right? But there's other ways. So what I would suggest in terms of meditation is use that effort, just start off with that effort. Okay, I'm going to breathe in, breathing out. And then once it kind of feels like it's doing its thing, see if you can start to back off on that a little bit. See how light can my effort be? How much effort, how little effort? And then you find that you go to a point where you lose it and you just become listless, and then you kind of bring that effort back. You know, basically wise effort is one of those things that if we look at the start of someone's meditative experience to, let's say, 10, 20, 30, 40 years down, effort overall should become more refined, more gentle, more soft. It doesn't mean that there's times when someone has to kind of kick the effort back up to kind of meet what the mind is doing. And that's probably another piece, is that, like for myself, sometimes I notice that I can sit with almost no effort, and there's just simply this availability to the present moment. Other times I have to breathing in, breathing out, because my mind is distracted, or I'm really caught by something, or I'm having to use investigation to get some of the turbulence that's in my heart. So you kind of learn to see, you basically have more repertoire of how effort is applied, right? So don't worry about having to use effort. Just see, how can I make it just maybe 2% less, maybe 3%, and then see what happens around that. And one piece to also to play with is, often when we have a lot of effort, we also have a lot of agenda behind it. I've got to do this. I got to get here. So you're doing a project, or I got to focus so I don't mess it up or make a mistake. In meditation, you kind of don't really have a lot of mistakes to make, right? It's low stakes basically. So you can notice, what's my agenda that's kind of driving the effort? And that's a big piece, is that the more you see through this nature of an isolated sense of self that has to obtain something, that has to get over itself, effort really falls down. It doesn't fall down, it really dissipates the perceived effort. And it really transforms to a very lighter quality. Yeah, thank you. Okay, go ahead, Emery.
Hi, thank you so much. It's really been sweet to hear about joy tonight. I appreciate how people have brought that up, and also about letting ourselves off the hook a little bit. So my question is kind of piggybacks on this idea of investigation.
Yeah.
Because when I'm concentrating and mindful in my meditation, yeah, it is pleasant, and it feels like sort of what I'm supposed to be doing. And then when an opportunity comes up to investigate, either because I am churned up or because, you know, like one thing that I'm investigating right now is my tendency to want to fix things.
Yeah.
And so like in my meditation, noticing how that feels in my body, what kinds of thoughts go with that, whatever. But all of a sudden my meditation goes from being pretty usually fairly peaceful and calm to like a lot of thoughts about why do I want to fix things? What is going on? Oh, yesterday I tried to fix this. Oh, right now I want to fix that. And so I'm wondering how to investigate without losing concentration, I guess.
That's good. Yeah, I think the big piece is you're trying to feel, they mentioned just a second ago, the felt sense, you know, how does it actually feel as a body experience? You know, and try to keep it, you know, you've probably heard me say this a number of times, but, you know, five parts, one part is thinking, the rest are all feeling, sensing in the body. Right. And so what happens is when we start to shift into the cognitive part of it, that's when you get that discursiveness or that proliferation and all these different pieces. And there may be a place for that, a time for that. But in the meditation, I think it's helpful to say, okay, let me feel this real time, kind of the impact of that. So like, let's say control, that's a great one. When I, and you might, if you can in daily life, you're interacting with your kids or your husband or your work or whatever it might be, and you feel that sense of control come up, see if you can just pause for a couple moments, close your eyes if it's appropriate, and feel that urge to control, exert control, and really take in the impact of what that feels like as a body experience. I mean, for me, there's often this almost this coiled spring quality that, okay, I've got to do something and I know this is the right way. It's going to be so much better for everybody if they just do it this way. And they don't, why can't they understand this? I've said it so many times. But I'm feeling all of that. It's like, okay, without acting from it, right? And then I feel that impact of it. And I feel how that in itself is suffering. There's a lot of suffering involved with that. And to the point where perhaps there's a sense of, okay, when's if maybe I'm not omniscient and know how the best way it should be. Maybe there's other, most many ways to do this thing. And maybe not doing it perfectly is actually perfect, that they learn something from that. You know, and so then you start to kind of coax yourself into that softening around it. But it's really a embodied quality. So basically kind of turn down the brain, bring up the body and heart.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. I forgot about that. I forgot about the body.
Yeah. Ask the body what's its experience around it.
Yeah. Thank you.
You bet. Yeah, you can start to see it, you know, moment by moment, real time. That's really transforms it. You can notice that with the mind, too. You start to feel the mind wanting to control something like the breath or some thought. And what does it really feel like to control? And here's a fun one. What happens if you completely let go of control? And you feel that little bit of panic, like if I'm not in charge, if I'm not doing something, if I'm not making it right or perfect. And then you start to surrender into that. Okay, I'll let things fall apart here for this and see what arises. And then you might find another side of it. There's a level of peace and joy and ease. All right, thank you, Emery. All right, we've come to our 9 o'clock hour. I appreciate all the questions. It's so helpful to kind of flesh out the teachings and kind of make it alive for you as the Sangha.